Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm Questo, your host. We have Team Supreme with us right about now. What's up, Steve? I never go to you first. How's your life? That's how your life is?
Is that a word?
What? Oh. Yeah, you know.
Everything's great, man. New York City, we're opening up. We've got a full audience at the Fallon Show. Everything feels good. Mentally, I'm a wreck. Thanks for asking. Let's move on.
Okay. Well, we're going to find out why you... Maybe you can get a reading from our guest today.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
Fontigolo is also here with us. What's going on, bro?
I'm good, bro. I'm good, man. Down 23 pounds, man.
What?
Like, yeah.
Is that louder than I usually am? Okay, I'll turn it down.
Believe it or not, it actually was.
Sorry.
As if she couldn't.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Nah, man, but up, I appreciate bro. The enthusiasm. Nah, man, you inspired me, man.
That's so, what's up, know, man. That is what's up.
And counting.
Yeah, I was about to say that I'm the king of, like, you know, doing 0 to 100 on the Autobahn. And then when you just got to do that, like, that last 30, then you start laxing off. So
all enough.
Yeah, right now I'm drinking and eating dandelions and other
untasty. You can eat those?
Yo, dog.
Dandelions are so bitter and horrible.
You just don't. But
you eat them too, Gina. You eat dandelions.
I tried.
They make wine out of dandelions.
If you do 2 weeks of this dandelion juice that I'm doing, that's I could probably drop like 40 pounds.
Yo, I hope everybody.
I'm just trying to get to
drop 40 pounds and your will to live.
Yes, exactly. All right, last up on the line, Luis, Laia, you cool? She's rather disgusted by what we just said.
No, I'm excited. I'm excited to have Gina on. I'm excited. Happy Tuesday to you, Gina. You ain't paid to post the video yet, but I'm waiting.
Happy Tuesday.
I'm late. I'm so late today. Okay. I've been all on back-to-back Zoom meeting today. I've not had a chance to do my tunes on Tuesday.
Yes.
All right. So that leads to our guest. Our guest today hails from my hometown of London, England.
Yours?
I never pass up a opportunity to speak on my little 3 years in London, and I just claim it like it's been my city of birth. She is a raw and hilarious British comedian with a Nigerian lineage, which isn't too far from my people's in Benin, but you know, I'll claim next door neighbor.
Let's do it.
She's also, in addition to being a hilarious comedian, she's one of the co-creators of the CBS MASH. Bob Hart's Abishola. I always thought it was Bob Loves Abishola, but of course it's Bob Hart.
I know, everybody thinks that, yeah.
Right, exactly. And if you've seen her work, you know that her life is an absolute open book. Speaking of which, her memoir, penned during the pandemic, I believe, is titled Cock Handed, which...
Cack, not cock!
Cock.
I was hoping.
Cack Handed, forgive me. Yes. No, this ain't on video, so we gotta say
yes. I'm still dead. I don't care.
No, cack handed. Let's hear it for the lefties in the house. I'm also a lefty. So
we're genius.
We special. You know, she shares her life and her experiences and her relationship with her family. A total open book. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to Questlove Supreme, Gina Yashere. I hope.
Perfect. Thank you. No, I was waiting. I was waiting with bated breath for the name. I was like, is he gonna mess it up?
No. I mean, it's easy. You're hooray with a yeah.
Exactly. Yes, hooray. Exactly.
Yeah. You're a comedian. Hooray. Yes, hooray. Okay, I'm stretching that, but you know. But everyone has done different variations of how to pronounce your last name.
Oh God, I get Yashere a lot. I'm like, no, it's Nigerian. Yashere, you almost have to shout my name.
Okay. Yashere. Okay, I get it now. I'm so glad you're here because, you know, I've been a fan of your work. You know, I've seen all three of your specials, well, three and a half specials on Netflix, at least. Very familiar with you. But, you know, we've never gotten a chance to talk or...
I know, I've seen you. I've walked past you on planes and gone, hi.
oh, so we've been okay. Two ships in the night.
I saw you on a plane once, and I was just like, all right. And I didn't want to make a big deal.
You should have said something.
Your time would be kind of inconspicuous, and I was like, I don't want to.
I call that a Tuesday. You know. Me inconspicuous. I don't know. So you were okay. So I'm glad you're here, simply because knowing how open you are about your life living in London and growing up there and your experiences, which of course, as an outsider with me, I didn't get to see those things. And of course, also in the pandemic, taking a crash course on small acts, which is, Steve McQueen's series.
Yes.
I was like, wow, did I ever live in London? Because I didn't realize that these experiences were going on over there as well. Like mine was slightly different because we were just a band trying to get our next gig. So, mm-hmm. you know, we very rarely did we get to truly like mingle with people that didn't have to do with like work or interviews or that sort of thing. So mm-hmm. can you talk to me about your experiences living in London? Like, I assume that everything that you speak on in your life is true.
100%, 100% okay. true. So I was born in London, East London, Bethnal Green. I am a Cockney by birth, like proper Cockney.
Okay.
Geezer, like war geezer, proper Cockney. So I was born in East London. I'm a child of the 70s. I'm a child of the 70s and 80s. And England was super racist. When my parents came to England in the 60s, super racist. That's when they had, you know, when people used to put signs on their doors. No dogs, no blacks, no Irish. So when you're going to rent a place, you know, you don't even need to bother ringing that doorbell if it's got that sign on the door. So this is what my mum and dad faced in England in the 60s. It was openly racist. And 70s and 80s, not much different. This was the time when the National Front were prevalent. National Front was a very far-right organisation in England. They tried to sort of style themselves a political party, but they were just a bunch of thugs. And their graffiti was ubiquitous. It was all over London. NF, NF, NF. And, I remember being chased and spat on by skinheads a lot when I was a kid, like 8 years old. I remember 8 years old being spat on by a skinhead. I remember me and my mum walking down the street and people shouting epithets out the car at us and swerving into puddles and splashing us. So that was London. That was like people, the Americans' view of the British being so genteel and polite. It's absolutely.
We never listen. When I went to London and I saw y'all niggas eating beans for breakfast, I understood how y'all used to rule the world.
Beans for breakfast is the shit.
That's some savage shit.
Nah, mate, you lot don't know how to eat beans. Beans are supposed
pudding.
To
be pudding. Yeah.
Beans on toast is the best thing on earth. Don't even try it.
Hey, that's some savage shit.
Are you really about to say that? Is English food better than Nigerian food, though?
No, Nigerian food is the best. Come on now.
Right? Come on now. Yeah, like some potatoes.
Everything came from us, man. Aren't you watching High on Hog?
So you're saying that you ride for all English things like Marmite sandwiches?
No,
and
I hate Marmite. Marmite, no. Beans on toast, yes. Bubble and squeak.
Bangers and mash.
I love a bit of bangers and mash. You can't beat it. But some of it, not so much. I don't do the black pudding. Ugh, it's basically.
Okay, I was going to ask. Okay, what is that? Can you explain to our audience?
Blood. Gelatinous pig blood.
Oh, Philly, close your eyes. Philly,
wait, time out. Ears. All these years that I've been having, I'll usually have the black pudding. They'll serve that when we're on like a ferry coming from like Europe, it's headed to the UK, and they'll have like black pudding as breakfast. You're telling me there's blood in that?
I mean, you eat pork?
It's made from pig's blood.
I did not know that.
It's disgusting anyway.
You're not going to make a comic moment out this, Laia. Have you seen how much I weigh? What, you think I'm being...
Hey man, just talk about drinking dandelion juice. I don't think pork chops is in the future.
It's not even the chops. The chops are delicious. It's just the blood. Yeah, black pudding. It's made from blood. It's gross.
And as we were explaining earlier, that, you know, in America, I think like the beans that are associated with pork and beans or hot dogs and pork and beans are kind of an afternoon evening dish, whereas in England that's a breakfast dish.
Baked beans, eggs and beans, chips, eggs, beans, eggs, beans, sausages. That's a proper breakfast. I know, when I first came to America and I was like, where's the beans, man? Where's the beans? And
Mexico does it in LA, but it tastes way better, I think, probably than what y'all
have. Yeah, but not.
I ain't got that one, Gina Yashere. I can't rap. The bangers and mash I can do. The bangers and mash I could.
And if you put the beans on top, it makes all the difference.
Oh God, no!
I love chips and beans. Oh my, you have no idea, man. You don't know. Wait. You don't know. You're lost.
Gina, I'm gonna tell you this much.
They got to be refried.
I miss touring so much.
Oh.
I'm actually going to side on your side of the fence. This time around. Normally I'd be with them like, yeah.
Okay, but wait, can I ask a question though? Because even though Gina is born and raised in London, her mother is not. And so I must think that your mother does not feel the same way about this English food. And on the back of that question, can you also break down like how dope and royal of a situation your mother came to come and then came to London and it was a flip of the switch?
Oh yeah. For one, my mom loves a bit of baked beans. Don't even knock it. My mom is full Nigerian. She loves Nigerian food. Like when we were kids, we ate Nigerian foods in the house. But my mom loved mashed potatoes and my mom loved baked beans. So it was the dichotomy. But yeah, my mom was from a wealthy, very well-known family. My mom's from a family called the Obaseki family, and they are practically royalty in Nigeria. And my mom was from a wealthy family. Her dad had a load of wives. She was educated. Her dad traveled all over the world on business and he took her with him. And she went to private school and she was a school principal in Nigeria before she was 24 years old. So she was very, she achieved a lot. And then she came to England to be poor.
Wow. Why did she come to England?
Well, long story short, if you read my new book that's coming out, that's out, you'll know that my mother was the daughter of the first wife. So my grandfather had many wives. As you know, polygamy was widely practiced in Nigeria.
Oh, tell me about that.
Oh, yeah, lots of wives.
You ain't got enough
I'm
money
asking
yet,
for
Paul.
A friend.
I know.
Lots of wives. And my mum was the daughter of the first wife. But the first wife was very powerful, as the first wife is, as the first. The other wives were very jealous. And there was the other wives murdered my grandmother. They poisoned. Yeah.
Oh, we never get into your career. You got to start from the beginning.
This is some Game of Thrones shit. Yeah,
for real.
Game of Thrones shit. So yeah, the other wives did not. My grandmother was like, listen, the other wives don't like me. These bitches are trying to kill me. If anything happens to me, get my daughter out of Nigeria. So she ended up dying. She was poisoned. And when she died, she had a mark on her throat. Now, before my grandmother died, she always used to say, when I come back, I'm going to speak English. I'm going to be in England. I'm not going to have all these children because my grandmother had 11 kids. I don't want all these children. I'm going to do a man's job. I'm going to have freedom. All of these things. When she died from the poison, she had a mark on her throat. Obviously, when she died, my grandfather sent my mum out of the country because he was like, well, I've killed the wife. I'm not going to have them kill my daughter too. So he sent my mum to England to study. And that is where my mum met my dad. They met each other. They had me. And I came out with this mark on my throat. So basically, I'm a reincarnation of my grandmother. So that's the story, because Nigerians believe heavily in reincarnation. And I came out doing all the things that my grandmother said.
I was about to say, yeah, you kind of fulfilled her legacy.
Fulfilled everything. So when I said, my mom was like, comedian, you want to become a clown? I was like, mom, remember, this is what your mother wanted. I am your mother. So that's how I get away with stuff. But yeah, that's how my mother ended up in England studying. And she was a teacher. She came to England. She wanted to carry on working as a teacher, but England was super racist. She couldn't. She met my dad. My dad was studying for his PhD. He was also a qualified lawyer. He couldn't get work as a lawyer in England. So basically, they met, they got married, they had us, and then my dad was like, forget this, I want to go back to Nigeria. This is not, I ain't driving a bus when I'm a lawyer. I'm a lawyer in Nigeria. I'm not staying here to drive a bus. Let's get the kids, let's go. And my mom was like, no, I've had my children in England. They are British. I want them to stay in England and be afforded all the opportunities that being British entails. I'm staying here with my kids. So basically, my mum and dad split up. My dad went back to Nigeria when I was 3, and I didn't see him again till I was 37 when I went out there to do a show in Nigeria. So that was it.
Wait, you met your father backstage at a show?
He came to my show. So, but at that point, I was pretty well known in England and pretty well known in Nigeria. I'd done a couple of sketches on television in England that had gone viral in Nigeria. So I got flown out to Nigeria to do a show. And obviously, I still carry my father's name. So my father was like, when I was going, my mom was like, oh, your father is going to turn up. You watch. He's going to turn up at the show. Wait, you wait
and claim you.
And he did. He turned up at the show with a bunch of brothers and sisters that I'd never met. So it was odd. It's all in the book. It's all in the book, people.
Okay.
Yes, it is. Yeah, and also in the book, I want to tell people too, you give a good history on the Empire of Benin and whatnot. I was like, oh wow, I had no idea. So
can you briefly let me know about, I just recently found out my lineage to Benin, like maybe Benin, a year ago.
Benin, the country next to Nigeria, or Benin, the city in Nigeria? Benin, the... Because there's two Benin. There's Benin City in Nigeria, which is where my family are from. And then there's Benin, the country, which is next to Nigeria, where they speak French. Yeah. So are you Benin? But if they say Benin in your, I'm assuming it's Benin, the country.
I believe that it was the country simply because when there was a civil war happening, the Nigerians had some Benin prisoners that mm-hmm. they used as leverage to negotiate. My great-great-grandfather was one of those captured and sold into slavery in America. So right, I believe it's the country.
Yeah, it's definitely the country then, Benin. Yes. But I do open my book with history of Nigeria and the Benin within Nigeria, which is now southern Nigeria and where my family are from, and how advanced the society was and how the British came and tried to take, and they got their asses handed to them by the Benin warriors. And then they came back and burnt Benin to the ground, stole all those bronzes. And hence why you've got all these Benin bronzes in museums in New York and around the world, because the British came, burnt down Benin, stole all the bronzes and sold the bronzes to pay for the army that they'd used to burn down Benin.
Mm. Ooh, man, the damage that the British have done to the world, man.
Oh, Jesus. British, yeah. Exactly. When you guys go, oh, Britain is so polite and genteel. No, it isn't. They are straight savages.
Well, and also, not for nothing, Nigerians usually act like ain't nobody come and mess with them at all. So this history is not always told in that aspect. It's like, ain't nobody come try to colonize us. We good. No, we good.
Why? Oh, no. They were colonized. We only got our independence. Nigeria only got their independence in 1960. From England. So 1960, we got our independence. And even then, the economy was completely messed up after that, because white people came out and took everything with them. And they'd already raped it of all the resources, all the oil, all the everything.
Mm-hmm. All the resources, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then there was a lot of money in oil for a while, but it all collapsed. It all collapsed. The school systems was based on the British school systems.
Dang.
You know, they took away the element that Nigerians were all about, Africans were all about family and learning trades and passing down stuff within the family. And the British came and went, nah, don't forget all that family stuff. Ah, no. Capitalism. It's all about capitalism. You learn, you get these qualifications, and then and so they completely changed the way that Nigerians worked, and it's just ruined, in my opinion, ruined the country. Now you've got a few greedy people just creaming everything off there. Just ruined. Mm-hmm. You know? So that's the history.
Hey, at least you know yours. You ain't have to go to African ancestry, right? Somebody, I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
When you were speaking of your family earlier, are you in an active kind of communication with them now? Like, how does the idea of a family reunion work? Or,
well, my dad died a few years ago. That side of the family, you know... He wasn't there for me. You know, I met him once when I went to Nigeria, and I was very polite to him because he, you know, he's the other half of my genetic tree. And I was very, you know, I'm Nigerian, so I was brought up to respect my elders. So when I met him, I'm not going to go, mother, you, I ain't seen you since I was three. I wasn't going to do that. So I was very polite. We sat, I took him to dinner, we talked. I asked him all the questions that I'd had from my childhood, like, why didn't you come back for us? Why? And he had a stack of letters that he'd been sending to us as kids that had all been returned, because my mother was like, get out of here. Because he broke her heart. You know, my mother was pregnant with my younger brother when my dad left. So imagine, she, in England, in the 70s, giving birth by herself.
As a single mom.
As a single mom in the 70s in England, where she had no family, nobody. And she and I was all, I had another brother. So it was me and my other brother were toddlers at the time. And she was giving birth to my youngest brother. So me and my brother had to go into foster care temporarily while she went into hospital to have this baby because she had nobody. So we went into care. You know, she got a white family to look after us while she went to hospital to have this baby. So my mother never forgave my father for that. Can you imagine being in hospital, all these women, all their husbands are coming in with flowers for their wives who've had these babies, and she's lying there by herself with absolutely nobody. So she never forgave him, never forgave him. So as a result, I kind of, you know, I'm not going to say I hated him, but I was like, look, you abandoned us. You know, I went through life with a horrible stepfather, horrible, and you never came for us. So I give you your due respect as my father figure, but that's all you're getting. So I met him the once. And after that, I was like, all right, I've met him. That was great. I took a few pictures.
That was all you needed.
You know, that's all I need. So, you know, when he died, his other kids are like, going, you know, are you coming for the funeral? And I'm like, no, I am sorry for your loss.
Okay.
He was a father to you, and I'm sorry for your loss. But I did not know the man. So, no, I'm not coming for the funeral.
What about your mother's big family?
Oh, my mother's side of the family, yeah. Not the wives who killed her mother. I didn't know any of those, but I've met many of my uncles, her sisters. Yeah, a lot of them came. A couple of them came to England. So my mum's side of the family, good. All her friends. Yeah, that's who I rock with.
Okay, I see.
That's what's up.
Hey, can you? Okay, I'm glad you're on the show to also clear up this conception, because Americans have a different, especially Black Americans, we have this different idea of who Nigerians are. Coming from this, I'll be real with it.
Listen, not in Houston, and not in Atlanta. But yes, outside of DC, Houston, and Atlanta, they don't know.
I know, but it's almost like a crazy stereotype that we never get to dispel that myth because we rarely have Nigerian guests on the show.
True. What's the stereotype?
But no, it's just basically like the idea Nigerians of the scamming. Nigerian scam artist that this invisible scam artist that. We are really
good at that shit. I mean, I can't even lie.
Oh, damn.
I'm
trying to get you to wipe it off the table. No, you just brought it back.
Look, Nigerians are very smart and very resourceful. And if you're stupid enough to fall for some of these scams and give them your money, then look, I went to Nigeria.
Man, I was 16, okay?
Look, it is going on. I went to Nigeria, and when I went to Lagos, I saw houses with signs on the houses that said, this house is not for sale. They had signs on the houses because what was happening, people were going on the internet and selling other people's houses. So selling houses that don't belong to them. So you're in the house and people knock on the door.
Genius.
Yeah, and people knock on the door and like, excuse me, what are you doing in my house? I just bought this house. Like, no, bitch, this is my house. But this is what was happening.
They brought that scam here, Gina. Are you aware that Nigerians brought that scam here? And there's a scam like all over your Craigslist, your favorite apartment search. You see a beautiful house and the price doesn't look believable. And then you call and they tell you to drive by and look at it from the outside. And they give you a long story about how somebody lost their job and somebody died. And da-da-da-da. Girl.
You fell for that one,
You
me?
Fell for that? Yeah, I was going
to
say.
No. I didn't fall. I just got to the part where you drive past the house.
I fell for that, right?
I remember someone tried that. You know, all the scams are out there. I remember someone, I was selling a phone years ago on, was it eBay or something? I was selling a phone. This is how long ago it was. It was on eBay. Selling a phone, and this Nigerian sent me an email going, listen, I think I wanted 300 for the phone or something. And this guy was like, I will give you 700. I'll give you 700. Just send me the phone and I will send you a Western Union. And I emailed him back and I was like, did you look at my name? Did you look at my name? You are trying to scam another Nigerian. Don't even try. Don't even try.
Now, Gina, is the scamming pure Nigerian or is it tribal specific? Because some may say that certain tribes are more scammy than others or not.
I don't know about that. I just think it's just, look, I'm not saying all Nigerians. It's a small percentage of Nigerians that are doing this. It's not all Nigerians. I can't do that shit. I don't even know how to. I would love to learn. But no, not all like, it's a small percentage. It's been blown up out of proportion to make it look like every Nigerian is scamming. There's a small percentage of them who are really, really good at it. But I trust it's a very small number. I don't know which tribe it is. I don't know.
I'm glad you cleared that up. Thank you.
I didn't clear that up, but you know what? Honesty. It's all about honesty, people. We're doing honesty. I'm being honest.
Facts.
Well, honestly, I gotta go. I gotta cancel this check I just sent out to somebody. I'll be right back.
You know, I could you tell us about creatively, what was your life like growing up in Britain at the time period, like your formative years, like 10, 11, 12, like your school existence, or just like, what did you generally do in during that time period?
Well, same as every other kid did try to just play, do my schoolwork. It was a struggle. Being an African kid was not cool at the time. And even though I say England was racist, it wasn't white kids I was fighting with at school. It was other black kids. The descendants of slaves from the Caribbean, African Caribbean kids. You know, because at the end of the day, they got the same education that we all got. And in the 70s and 80s, the view of Africans, the only image of Africans on TV was either sitting there with flies landing on our face, begging for food donations, or in Tarzan movies, chasing white men around and trying to and cook them in pots with bones in our noses. So we were seen as primitive and heathen and animalistic. And that was what the image of Africans was at the time. So as an African kid at school, I would put up with, you guys in America, it was African booty scratcher. In England, it was African bubble, spear chucker, all of that stuff. Yeah. And it was black kids who called it that, because the British were so good at hiding their because this is the thing you don't know about. The British, the Europeans were the biggest slavers, biggest. Mm-hmm. The Belgians were disgusting. The Dutch were disgusting.
Britain was number one.
Belgium, like England was number one. The British Empire, they were number one. They just hid it better. Like I used to do this routine where I say the Americans did the equivalent of stealing shit, as in stealing people and bringing it back to their own house. Whereas the Brits stole, but kept it in other people's houses. So they went to Africa, they stole people, but they didn't bring them all back to England. They put them on, you know, their colonies in the Caribbean.
Colonies,
Right?
Barbados,
St. Kitts, Jamaica, all of those people are descendants of slaves. All the black people from the islands. But they did not educate the black people from the islands as to where they came from. They just assumed that they were from the islands, that there are black people from Africa and there are black people from the islands. They didn't know. So I had so many fights at school with kids who'd be calling me names. I go, fuck, do you not know that you're African too? You came from, I ain't no African, I'm a Jamaican, I ain't no primitive, I don't run around with no bones in my nose. I used to get that at school. And it wasn't until Roots came out in England that they went, mind blown.
It's all the same thing.
Because they were not educated. It's not their fault. They were not educated. The school system did not educate us to tell us that all black people came from Africa. They didn't know it. So at school, I went for a horrible time with other black kids just calling me names. I was constantly getting into fights at school. And that's where I started using humor, because I was getting into too much trouble, because I had to make myself into the crazy kid. Don't mess with her because she will punch you in your face. Tall, big, small, you know, I would fight. I'd be ready to fight to show so that I wouldn't get bullied. I'd be like, I will fight any of you. Don't even try. I will fight you. So then I started using humor to kind of circumvent those, you know, those confrontations. That was my life at school.
Okay, so it's weird to hear you say that, because in my mind, I thought that type of ignorance was just for America. Because, I also, you know, had experience like that in the mid-70s or whatever. Like the worst insult you could say, like on the playground or whatever, and on recess, is to call someone African. Like that's when it's like, yo, I'm ready to fuck you up.
Yeah.
You say that to me again. But, you know, to hear that this also is happening with African kids over,
it's white supremacy.
White
supremacy. They indoctrinated the entire planet. I mean, it's genius what they did when you think about it. A generation of people.
You get up off the floor, please.
I'm sorry. I'm also dying because I do another podcast with Jill Scott and Asia from Kindred. And Asia always says the root of everything that has to go on with black people is white supremacy. So it's just
Absolutely. Wow. They're genius. Not even the fact that they subjugated us, that they convinced us that we were less than. And generations later, hundreds of years later, we still believe that we are less than. We still do. Hence, you have all the, you know, African-Americans hate Africans, Haitians hate this. Everything stems from that. The religion that was forced upon us to have us believing in a white Jesus and a white God. The religion that's forced upon us, the homophobia that was never existent in African society. We were spiritual.
Wait a minute.
Do you practice Yoruba?
Sorry?
Do you practice Yoruba, the religion, or...
I don't practice any religions, really. I've pulled out from all of them.
Are you Yoruba?
No, my family are from Benin City.
That's what I thought.
Different tribe.
Okay.
Different tribe. But yeah, like if you look back in history, homophobia was not existent in Africa. It was all about spirits. You know, there are historical pieces written by white people who came to Africa.
What happens now? So now they sell, because somebody literally just told me that Ghana just took down the sign at their airport, basically saying, don't bring your American homosexual
Christianity. Basically, the Brits came in and they were like, what are you doing? You're worshipping these deities, these wooden artifacts. This stuff that you're doing is wrong. It's disgusting. It's heathen. You will worship this white Jesus. And they built churches. And they took the land to build these churches, and they beat the religion into the people. And it's been passed down for generations. They don't even know where the religion comes from. So the Christianity and all that stuff was not there before. It wasn't there. We worship the land. We worship our own deities. We worship the spirits within people. So yes, there were men that had more feminine energy, but it was no big deal. There were women who had more masculine energy, but people just were there. It was all about the spirits of the people. Same thing within the indigenous tribes of every country. You know, they had different genders and it was all about the spirit. And some of these people with different genders or different identities were considered more spiritual than some. They used to go to them for advice and things like that. So this was what it was like before the white missionaries came.
Yeah.
And they were like, stop all of this. This is heathen, this is animalistic. You will worship our white Jesus, you will go to our churches, and we will give you our education. And if you don't do it, we will kill you. So while we're building your churches, we will take all your land to build these churches that you did not know you needed, and you will worship in them.
Yeah.
And we may sell some of your family. But that's just how it is. We are bringing you civilization. And that's basically what happened. So the religion that you see is bastardized. It's been used by men to subjugate. This is the same religion that was used to justify enslaving black people.
Oh yeah, I was about to say, you know, yeah, we know all about this. Yeah. We
same religion.
Some of us try to act like we forgot, but yeah.
So you know, I'm like, this same religion that you're using to beat people over the head because they're home. This is the same religion that was used to subjugate your people for hundreds of years. This is the same religion. They're the same colonizers that you claim to reject. But you're not rejecting the bullshit that they taught you, you know.
When you occasionally bring this up in concert, like when you really get real about the effects of racism, knowing that you have a mixed audience, like what's the general reaction and how do you handle it if someone claps back at you? Because I saw Chappelle try to do this once and it didn't work with his sort of drunk frat boy, I'm Rick James bitch audience that was wanting him to just, you know,
just
be a caricature and, you know, he had to turn Dick Gregory on them.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. The audience that tend to come to see me know that I just say what I'm going to say. So if you're coming to see me, you know that you're getting what you're getting. Mm. Also, as a comedian, my first port of call is always to entertain. I'm here to make you laugh. I'm not a teacher. I'm not a lecturer. That's not what I'm here to make you laugh. So that is always my first port of call. You need to be laughing. Now, if I'm slipping in some politics and slipping in something that's teaching you something, as long as you're laughing, it's all good. So I don't go out there and just go hard and go, white man is the devil. I don't do that. I tell stories. I tell stories of experiences from my life. Because just by virtue of who I am, I am a walking political statement. So I don't have to make a big deal out going, I'm black. I'll just tell stories. I'll tell stories about the racist woman on the train who didn't believe that I belonged in first class. I'll tell the stories of being in the first class lounge at the airport and a guy asking me where the eggs are. I will just tell stories. I will tell the stories.
Wow.
And they learn from the stories. They're laughing, but they're learning at the same time. And that's how I do it. It's like feeding medicine, but you coat it in sugar, so you don't really know you're taking the medicine. And that's how I tend to do it as a stand-up comic. So I don't go, you know, obviously people still get angry, because white people always get angry. That you got, I call them the defensive white people, the DFWs, who will get upset with, if you just mention race, they're going to get upset. And I've been called racist by someone. You're racist. Talking about white people. I'm like, talking about racism does not make you racist. You got to know the difference. You're defensive. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like, just get out of my face. But yeah, but an audience who comes to see me know that they're going to have a good time. They're going to laugh a lot. Mm-hmm. And they may come out with some knowledge. But really, they're coming to enjoy a show. And that's what it's about for me.
I know that before A Life in Comedy, you were preparing for a life as an engineer.
I wasn't preparing. I was an engineer. I worked.
Mm-hmm. Right. What came first? Your need to make people laugh, or, you know, I would assume that was it a desire to be this engineer, or was it like, let me fall back on something
No, the desire to make people laugh, it wasn't a desire. It came out of necessity to avoid fights. I didn't think it was something I could do for a living. I just used that.
It was a defense mechanism.
Yeah, it was a defense mechanism. Okay. But I come from an African family. We're very academic. So my mom was like, you know, I do a routine on stage where I go, there's four choices of career in an African family. Doctor, lawyer, engineer, disgrace to the family. Those are the choices. So I was meant to be the doctor. My mom told me from the age of 2 that I was going to be a doctor. It wasn't until I got to 18 and we had to dissect a rat that I discovered I couldn't stand the sight of blood. So I switched from studying to become a doctor to engineering, because that was the next on the list. So I became an engineer. I got my degree in electrical electronics engineering, and I became an engineer. And I enjoyed the work. I was never going to be the best engineer in the world, though. I was okay. I did well. And also, I was, you know, my last job was working for Otis, building, repairing elevators. His name was Elijah Otis, the man who supposedly invented the elevator, even though he probably had a black person helping him do that, as they
did.
But the guy who is credited with inventing the elevator was a white man. People think he's a black guy because of the name Otis, but his name was Elijah Otis. He was a white dude.
Okay.
But I worked for Otis Elevator, building and repairing elevators, that as an engineer. And I was their first female engineer in their 100-year history in the UK. Of this company in the UK. And it sounds amazing, but it was not. I worked on construction sites with white men, and I was the only woman engineer and a black engineer in that, and the same pay grade as these people, while being much younger than all of them. I went through a baptism of fire. Like, you're on a construction site, there's no HR. There's no one to say, oh, you're not allowed to say that. I got called the nigger to my face every day at work. I'd come into work and there's pictures of monkeys above my overalls, or there's banana skins in the pockets of my overalls, and they'd be giggling as I'm taking out these banana skins and throwing them away. This is what I put up with at work every day for 4 years. I stuck it out because I had to prove that I could do the job. I had to prove to them that they're not going to scare me out of this, that I'm as good as they are. And the more they hated me, the more I came into work, because they wanted to drive me away and I was not having it. But in the end, I had to pull a guy aside and threaten him with physical violence. I was like, listen, you keep calling me a nigger. I've got 2 brothers. I'll send these 2 niggers around your house to fuck you up. I know where you live. So that if you call me nigger once more, you're a dead man. And that was it. He never spoke to me again.
Damn.
And work got quieter. But
wait,
that was
you were
my
hoping
job.
She did that?
Why? I was hoping. Either way, I was. I wanted
She'd
him
be
to
in
meet.
Jail
I wanted,
right now.
I wanted him to meet a nigga. I did.
Yeah, he didn't get to, because he shut his mouth quick when I told him I knew where he lived and I'd send my brothers around there. So that was what I put up with every day at work for years. And then the only reason I ended up leaving the job, I was good at the job, the only reason I ended up leaving, because I wasn't getting the promotions I was supposed to, because I was a woman, I was their first woman, they didn't know what to do with me.
That's crazy.
So I'd be like, well, I've done this, I've earned this, I've done this promotion, I've got the promotion, you give it to me on paper, you've given me the money, now I'm supposed to run my own site. Because when you get to a certain level, you then manage your own site. And they were like, well, we don't have to date the geezers. We don't know if the guys are going to listen to a bird. You know what I mean? Don't think they're going to listen to a girl giving them orders. So we'll give you the promotion, we'll give you the money, but you can't manage your own site. So I was like, well, then this is not good. I'm going to go to a grievance hearing. So I set up a hearing. My union that I've been paying into for 4 years refused to represent me. My union rep was like, we don't know about this women stuff, so you're on your own. So I turned up for this grievance hearing, unrepresented by my union. So here I am, 21-year-old black girl, in a room with these old white men who are at the top of the company. And obviously I lost. They were like, we don't see we're doing anything wrong. Get out of here. So in the end, I was like, I'm out of this job. They were, you know, in the mid-90s, they were making people redundant. The building industry went through a bit of a slump. They were laying people off. They were never going to lay me off because I was their black poster child. But I just marched into my manager's office and I was like, you better pay me off and let me go or else I'm going to go public with this shit. So they were like, all right, here's your money. Off you go. And it was in that time that I fell into comedy because I was like, let me take a little bit of time out of engineering. Let me have some fun. Let me go do some.
You had a little cushion.
I had a little cushion. I had the money. I had a little apartment where my rent was cheap. My car was bought cash. I had this nice little nest egg of money. So I lived off that money. And it was in that time that I fell into comedy and just ended up never going back to engineering.
Around what year was that?
I'd say 90. I started doing comedy in 96. So yeah.
Oh, wow. 96, oh, yeah. Damn. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So at the time, who were you laughing at? Like, who was making you laugh?
Funny enough, I never really watched comedy before I did it.
Oh.
I'm not one of those comedians that's got an encyclopedic knowledge of comedy. I like to watch my peers. I never watched a lot. Because I tried to watch Richard Pryor videos, but when I came, I'd seen so many comedians doing versions of his stuff that by the time I saw him, I was like, I've seen this already. And it sounds horrible to say this publicly.
No, that's real.
I've never watched an entire Richard Pryor special because I felt like I'd seen it because I'd seen bastardized versions of it
right
so often.
Yeah, Pryor is one of those dudes, like I always compare him to, like, he's kind of like what Jay Dilla was to music in the sense that you're trying to explain him. You had to be there and trying to explain him to people. Now they don't understand it. Like, yo, before this guy happened, all this shit that y'all rocking to now, like that shit just did not exist. You know what I mean? And it's hard to explain that to people, you know? And Richard Pryor, he was kind of like that. When I would watch him, you know, all my uncles and shit be laughing at him, but I'd be like, huh? You know what I mean?
Right.
But
I was going to ask about Mom's Mabley, and I was curious if you ever...
No, I mean, I've gone back and researched it.
That's what I meant,
So I've gone back and gone, Mom's Mabley. Like, we didn't have Mom's Mabley in England. We would not have known who she was. It's only when I moved to America that I started looking at the history of black comedy in America. I mean, we had Eddie Murphy, obviously, in England. He was huge. He was a worldwide superstar. So I saw Raw. You know, everybody saw that. And then we used to get the VHS tapes of the Def Comedy Jams. So we got So we got Def Comedy Jam in England. We all watched so when I ended up doing Def Comedy Jam, all the black British comics were like, oh my God, you're doing that. It was a massive thing because we'd all been sneaking and watching the VHSs of Def Comedy Jam. So, but when I came to America, that's when I started, you know, Chris Rock, we knew who Chris Rock again, you know, we got all the movies.
He came there too, yeah.
Yeah, he came and toured, so we knew who Chris Rock was. Chappelle's Show came later on. We did get Chappelle's Show, but I never watched Chappelle's Show. I never watched it because it was at that time when I was, I don't know, when was Chappelle's Show? It was like
2003.
So I was already in comedy in England, just hustling. So I never really watched a lot. I've never seen all of, I've seen clips of the Chappelle Show on the internet, but I was not really watching TV like that. I've never even watched the Fresh Prince. I know, I've watched clips of it. I've seen it. I know the show. I know what it's about. I watched the documentary of it. But when it was on, I never actually watched the show.
Yeah, once you've seen a few clips, you've seen them all.
Oh,
I'm playing. No, well, okay. So from my observation, you know, when I'm watching people talk about English comedy, of course, Fawlty Towers and Monty Python and whatnot. What did black people, would you say?
White English comedy. When they say English comedy, it usually means white people.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. But what were black people holding on to as far as comedy was concerned in the late 60s, early 70s? Like, what was Monty Python for black people?
Nothing. Yeah. Nothing.
Really?
I didn't give a shit about Monty Python. I never found it funny. I didn't get it. Was just a bunch of very wealthy middle class white guys. This is how Monty Python sounded to me. That's all it sounds like to me. I never watched it as a kid. I didn't get it. You know, I just didn't get it.
I didn't get much, but Benny Hill, I was just thinking that.
But yeah. Benny Hill was physical comedy.
Right. Exactly. I was a kid watching that, and it was funny.
As a kid, I watched that. I mean, as a kid, there was a guy called Kenny Everett, who I found hilarious. If you ever look up clips of this guy on YouTube, Kenny Everett, hilarious. Mm-hmm. Okay. Hilarious. He was funny, and he was who I watched on TV. We had Lenny Henry, who was our black comedian. One top black comedian in the UK. So we watched a lot of his stuff, a lot of scare. So we had stuff, we had TV shows with Caribbean actors on it. So we had our shows, but as far as black comics in the 60s, a lot of the black comics in the 60s did very self-deprecating humor that was for white audiences. You know, they do-
Similar to our minstrel comedy for America.
Very much.
There was a version of that for the UK as well?
Oh, yeah, the Black and White Minstrel Show was a British show. It was on in the UK. And then we also had so Lenny Henry, he was our one black comic, and black people looked at him sideways for a long time because he did appear in the Minstrel Show. But he was a young black comic. There was nothing out there. He was the one, and he just did what he was told to do. But, yeah, he did appear in the Minstrel Show, so black people were like, for a long time.
So what year did the Minstrel Show stop in the UK?
Not for a long time.
Did it stop?
It went on for, I think it didn't even stop till like the early 90s. It went on for a long time. I might be exaggerating, but I know it was on for a very long time. Whoa. It stopped way after it should have stopped.
Right.
Yeah.
Damn. Yeah. Okay.
Way past the sell by date.
Well by. Way past.
So how does one cut their teeth and navigate through the early structure of trying to be a comedian? Like, what clubs and like, how are you able to do that? And also, you know, were they open to you being a woman, a black person? How hard was it to sort of rub shoulders? And
when I started in comedy in the 90s, there was a burgeoning black comedy scene. There was a huge, you know, it was very segregated. So we had a black comedy scene, which was made up of theatres, black run theatres. There were lots of good underground roots theatres around the country. And there was a promoter called John Simmet who used to put on shows all around. And he used to bring over American comics to do our shows. Like, I met J.B. Smoove 25 years ago, at Ian Edwards. I met all of these guys 20 odd years ago when I was starting out in England. I went to see them at theatres in England in the 90s before they became huge. So this guy, John Simmet, was putting on all these shows. So there was a really good comedy scene, not in comedy clubs, it was theatres, it was events. The black scene was an event. They put in their face on the flyer and people came and got dressed up and it was a big event. So that's where I started doing comedy on the black scene. The white comedy scene was mainly comedy clubs and there were a lot of them all over the country. So you could make, the black scene paid more money because it was more of an event, but there weren't as many of them. So you might get one, you know, we might get one show every couple of weeks paying $300, whereas on the white circuit, they paid less money, but you got a lot of work if you got into the clubs. I've always made a point of playing both sets, playing the black scene and the white scene immediately. From the beginning, I was like, I want to be funny to everybody and I want to make all the money. Because I'm a Nigerian, so that's how I thought. I want to make all the money, so I want to do all the clubs. So I made a point of playing both. People used to say, how are you going to go do the white circuit? You're a sellout, whatever. But I never sold myself out. I always was pretty much quintessentially me when I did those shows. So, yeah, and that's what I did. It was hard. It was a struggle. It was a struggle getting on at those clubs because they didn't respect black comedy. They always thought that black comics were this. The same as it is in America, the assumption that every black comic is a Def Jam comic or every black comic talks a certain way. That's how it was in England. They thought that all we talked about is our parents beating us or whatever. So it was a struggle getting on at those clubs, but I worked it and, you know, I did. I kept hustling and kept festering these clubs and I did get on, but you know, it was hard getting on TV. I was always the token, always right. The token. I was always on TV. I was on all manner of TV shows. You know, I was famous for being that black girl that's on every show in England. Mm. Never had my own show. So when these shows got accused of racism, they go, but no, we're not racist. Look, we had Gina. We've had Gina on our show 8 times. So I realized I was being used as a token to keep other black people down. So I was like, I've got to get out of here. I've got to get out of here.
Damn. I was told that I was trying to figure out in American comedy, when blacks are trying to get to that mainstream level, like, you know, how do you get out of what we call the Chitlin circuit into mainstream comedy? Some black comedians joke with me, the one thing you can't do when you decide to go mainstream is, I guess the common denominator is amongst comedians is you're Def Jam comic if you're fucking the chair. So
it's a lot of chair humping, a lot of chair humping.
Exactly. So what is the, what's the sort of the signature kind of blanket move for black comics in the UK that sort of,
well, a lot of black comics in the UK kind of model themselves on the Def Jam comics. So there was also some stool humping in England as well, but
white people fuck like this.
When I started doing comedy, you know, I was the only comedian of African descent that was really doing it. A lot, 90% of the comedians were Caribbean descent. So a lot of their jokes were doing jokes at the expense of Africans. So when I came out, I was coming from a different perspective. So that made me stand out immediately from everybody else. Cause I was like, yeah, you guys are talking about Africans. Jamaicans, let me tell you about yourselves. Bajans, let me tell you about yourselves. And so I was coming from that perspective. And I did material about being an African kid and the experiences at school. So I came from that perspective. So it made me stand out, made me different, and it made me successful earlier because I was very different from everybody else. But then what happened was I started a trend because I was able to parlay that into mainstream success on television, talking about my African heritage on British television. Then I started a whole stream of young comics of African descent who were like, oh, we can talk about being African. And then it almost became hack because I was doing characters, my African characters, which were characters well written, but a lot of these younger comics were just coming out and going, look, I can talk in an African accent and it's really funny. And people were laughing at that. So then it became hacky.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, you mentioned the Lenny Henry show earlier, and that's where you did more of your sketch, your character actors. How did you develop Tanya, one of your more famous characters, Tanya, and I love the fact that you wore a bootleg Allen Iverson jersey. I'm from Philly, and the other character, Mrs.
Amokrede.
Yeah, how did you develop those characters for that show?
Well, Mrs. Amokrede was based on my mom, so I'd been doing various versions of her in my stand-up before that. So all I did was just make her a person and put the wig on and actually encapsulate the character. Tanya was based on the young girls I used to see on the buses and see on the streets when I used to hang out. And I used to listen to their conversations and their voices and stuff. But when they called me on the show, they called me to be a writer. They didn't call me to be on the show.
On the show, okay.
They wanted me to write on the show. And I was like, well, I'll write on the show, but the characters that I come up with, I want to play them. That's the only reason I'm a comedian, I'm a performer. I don't want to just write sketches and be in the background. So I was like, if I write on the show, but if I create these characters, I want to play them. And that's basically how I got on the show as a writer and performer. And lucky I did, because those characters catapulted me to mainstream success. Up until that Lenny Henry show, I was what you call hood famous. Because I'd done a black TV show and I was famous to black audiences. So when I was selling out theatres, it was all black. But then when I got on the Lenny Henry show, that was mainstream BBC television in the UK. And my audience changed. I started to pick up a much bigger and broader audience, which I still hold to this day. So I still kept my black roots because I never changed who I was. But then white people came on board.
Oh, word. Mm. So I know eventually you came stateside. What was the decision process to leave the UK to move to America?
Well, I wanted to be in America since I was a child. Since watching Different Strokes, I was like, I want to go to America and be adopted by a rich white man and have a white maid. Like, It was my dream. I used to watch all your TV shows. I'm like, kids in America, they got better candies than us. They got better clothes than us. They got better bikes. They can go around and solve crimes and shit. I want to be an American kid.
Crimes.
Yeah. So when I was 4 years old, I used to say to my mom, like, why did you come here? So I never felt British. I was like, why did you come here? Like, you could have gone to, I could have been born in Miami. Like, what are you thinking? So it's been a dream. Like, even when I worked for Otis as an engineer, Otis is an American company. True. So all my life, I was planning to come to America. Even when I was working as an engineer, I was like, I'm going to work for an American company. And at some point, I'm going to transfer and be an engineer in America. So it's been my dream to live here my entire life. How I got here as a comedian, last comic standing. I saw it as a chance to get to America. And so I auditioned for the show and got to the semi-final, and they got me a 2-year work visa. And I was like, oh, does this mean I can live and work in America for 2 years? Oh, well, I'm done. Went back to England, sold my house, sold and gave away everything I owned, and turned up for the semi-final of Last Comic Standing with just 2 suitcases to my name, and threw a big party in England, said, I'm leaving, I ain't coming back. Goodbye. I know it's only a 2-year visa, but I'm going to turn this into a green card, and then I'm going to turn it into citizenship. I am never coming back.
Into a dynasty. Nice.
And there you go. And I've been here 14 years.
So wait, is that for real? Like, before you came here, you saw all the, like, the beauty of America, but you had no idea of, like, what was really going on and the history.
I knew what was going on, but okay. The same shit was happening in England. I'm just, there's no difference to me. I'm just going from, you know, as a comedian in England, a black comic, I was well known. I'd got quite famous, but I'd hit the glass ceiling of where black people are allowed to reach in English entertainment industry. So I was like, well, America's got a black ceiling, but it's a lot higher. So at least when I hit the black ceiling, the glass ceiling in America, I'll be a multimillionaire when I hit it, and I can cry in my money. So that was my idea.
I love it.
Because you are the queen. You are the queen of comedy in London. There ain't queens of comedy.
Yeah, I am the most, you know, well-known black female comedian.
I love it. I love it.
Or one of the most well-known comedians standing in England. But I was here and my white male counterparts here. So I'm here and I'm doing pretty well. I've got, you know, I'm doing well. But then these white guys who opened for me, and then going, boom, and becoming stadium-filling multimillionaires. And I'm like, wait, a year ago, you were opening for me. How am I still here and you're here? I need to get out of here. I need to go and swim with the sharks in America.
This is mind-blowing, because I'm thinking to myself, like, so now that you're here, and this is a different time now. It's a time now where, you know, in Hollywood, it makes more sense for you to be black and British, black and African descent. You know, like, a lot of there's an issue that people speak about sometimes, that you are first choice when it comes to roles a lot of times. Like, what is your view on that?
I don't think that's true, though. I don't think
Talk about it.
Look, here's the thing with the whole African-American versus Africans and or versus Brits thing. Mm-hmm. If there were enough roles, enough well-rounded, three-dimensional roles for black actors in America, we wouldn't be fighting over these crumbs. We're fighting over crumbs. And here's the thing. I say they say that British black actors are first choice. No, they're not. How many African-American characters have played Nelson Mandela? How many?
How many? Only three.
Denzel Washington played Steve Biko. All our African heroes have been played by African-American actors. Yeah. But we didn't complain. Yeah, we just were happy that our story is
Terrence being Howard even played Nelson Mandela.
Well, that's all
I forgot. Fonte. You don't have to remind us.
Wait, he did?
He was him and Jennifer Hudson played Winnie. It was
the Winnie movie. It was the Winnie movie. So.
Did he say it was.
Mandela.
Y'all want me to end apartheid, man.
But that's what I'm saying. What is the big complaint? What is the big complaint? Cross-pollination. We had a movie in England called For Queen and Country. It was a movie about a British soldier coming out of the army.
For Queen and Country. I remember this movie. Yeah.
Denzel Washington played that British soldier. Of all the black actors in England, they went to America and brought Denzel Washington to England to play the role of this British soldier. So It's cross pollinated. This is, you know, the, all these complaints.
Did he played Steve Biko too. He was Steve Biko.
I said that earlier. He played Steve Biko. So all our African heroes have been played by African Americans.
Well, it's well, now it's y'all turn. Now.
Yeah, now it's y'all turn. Say,
you, about
the way
to say,
I see it, I see
everybody's
it
English. Everybody's from the UK.
Right? Well, Harriet Martin. I mean, she.
Listen, did they do the role justice?
That's all. That's where I'm at with it too. They bodied the shit.
It depends on the movie.
The role
it,
justice.
It depends on.
That's all you got to ask. You got. That's all you got to. You know, look. Will Smith played a Nigerian doctor in horrible.
Tell the truth.
Why'd you have to mention
look,
that?
I love Will truth. Smith. I love Will Smith, but that was horrible. Just horrible. Black Panther. I love Black Panther. That was the I love that movie, but every member of that family had a different African accent. Different African accent.
But
Forrest Whitaker had my favorite.
Why you ruin this?
I blame Lupita. She should have taught everybody correctly. I don't know.
Exactly. I don't think that's on her. Yeah, that's not on her.
It's a bad joke.
Here's the thing.
She
messed up.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Look, I'll tell you a little story. When I came to meet Chuck Lorre to create Bob Hart's Abishola, I asked them what they wanted the African character to be called. And one of the guys said, Lupita. And I was like, okay, stop.
Oh, hell no.
Oh, what?
Here's the thing. I was like, this is why you guys need me. For one, Lupita is Kenyan. You're talking about Nigerian character. She's Kenyan. Wrong side of Africa. Wrong side of Africa. Two, she was born in Mexico. Her parents, for shits and giggles, gave her the name Lupita. I can pretty much guarantee there's not another fucking African on the planet. There is it. So here we go. Let me give you a list of Nigerian names. Let me help you. Let's make this authentic. Let's make this good.
Thank guys.
And thank you.
I was about to say, I don't even want to skip this far into it, but I had a friend that used to act on 2 and a Half Men, and I went to the set to visit just to see like what the atmosphere was like. And, you know, Chuck Lorre shows are, it's the most intense atmosphere I've ever seen as far as a comedy show is concerned. Like I didn't know he was that hands on. I didn't know that every time they yell break, the writers run around. All right, give me a better punch. Better punchline, go. No, you're horrible. Go. No, you suck. Wait, you work for me? Like, I never knew it was that cutthroat.
That's Chuck Lorre doing that? Is that Chuck Lorre?
It's not as bad on our show. He's mellowed with age. And also, because I'm running the show with Al Higgins and him, our atmosphere is a lot more chill. It's a lot, you know, I brought black writers in, you know, like,
Well, they need you to make it work, so I doubt it. But I'm just saying that what I saw.
I was high was pressure. It's like every time they take a break. NBA of sitcoms. It's the NBA.
It is. Like every time they take a break, and I could tell what not the lineage, but I could tell the order of like the respected writer versus the newbie, because you're supposed to form a circle around him, and he's like, I don't like that punchline. Give me something that works. Go. And if you don't nail bullseye with the right punchline, he'll be like, nah, that sucks. You and I'm just seeing like people getting deflated every time they don't come with the magic.
Oh yeah,
I didn't realize is that
Chuck does not suffer fools gladly. Luckily, I'm a stand up, and I came in with that confidence of a stand up. And you know, look, not every one of your jokes is gonna work. It's the not showing fear when it doesn't. Oh my god, it didn't work. I've got to think of something quick. And these guys who just talk incessantly because they're trying desperately to impress. You just got to be chill. Like, he likes me because I'm chill around him. I'm just like, here's a joke. No, that didn't work. Okay, give me a couple minutes. And I'm quite relaxed about the whole thing.
That's why I wanted to ask you, because in that particular atmosphere, in that particular day that I saw, I just don't know how one can be creative when they all look like they were like had their heads in the guillotine.
Under the gun. Yeah.
Right, exactly. And I'm like, well, how can you come with something creative when you're under such duress? And I wanted to know, was it like that on the set as well? Like,
no.
Where
our set is a fun set. Before we do our run-throughs and rehearsals, I put on Afro beats, we dance.
Yes, yes.
I put on music. Like, if you look at my stories and stuff, you'll see me and the cast, the crew, all of us, we put the music on, we fuck it, and we dance. I'm like, let's go. Just get the energy. Just get, it's fun. This is fun. We're playing make-believe, like, people. This is not rocket science. This is not surgery. So I put music on, we dance, we have fun. And the writer's room is a really nice collaborative feel. And Chuck likes the room that we're running. And Chuck comes in and he loves coming and hanging with us. And it doesn't feel high pressure. We're talking, we don't write. Because the show, if you watch Bob Hart's Happy Show, like, it's not a joke-heavy show. It's funny. Mm-hmm. And we aim for the funny, but we also aim for the real heart, the real story, the real three dimensions of all the characters. So it's not just joke, give me a joke. We need a joke right now. We need a joke. You know, the funny comes. We concentrate. Chuck has now taught us, look, we concentrate on the story, make it real. And then you can add in the jokes later. So, you know, I've learned a lot since in that show, but we haven't got that kind of high intensity thing going on. We all, it's a collaborative thing. Everybody works together. We break, you know, and you know, I've had people come up to me after the season and go, look, this is one of the best sets I've ever worked on, because your energy is positive and fun and you keep it light and it's not high pressure and we enjoy coming to work. So that's what I'm trying to do.
I was going to say, if it wasn't desirable, I think we would have heard it from you right now in your comedy.
Oh, absolutely. I've got a whole routine about how this show came about. Them finding me on Google, all of that. I've got a whole routine about it. Chuck has heard it and he's like, oh God.
So I also want to, you know, commend you on, you know, I know that the rule of comedy is supposed to be like tragedy plus time equals humor, or mm-hmm. I guess that's the formula. But, you know, all of your subject matters, you somehow find the seriousness in things that are like, you know, you leave nothing, no stone unturned. Like, you talk about sleep apnea, you talk about lupus,
oh wow,
you know, coming out to your family, all these things. Where did you get to the place where it was like, because I think you have to not care in order for your world to open up. Like, usually if people are super guarded and
yeah,
that sort of thing, then you're not going to work. But to, you have to get to the point where you
don't give a shit anymore.
Yeah.
It took a long time.
When did you reach that level?
Not that long ago. You know, I wasn't out for a very long time because I was like, I'm a black woman in this industry. I don't look a certain way. Like, do I really want to give them something else to box me in with? So for a long time, I did not talk about my sexuality at all. I avoided the question. I never lied, but I always circumvented the questions. If they asked the questions, I'd be like, I was doing this stuff. So at the beginning of my career, it helped me because I had to think outside the box as far as material was concerned. Because when everybody else was talking about relationships, I had to go, right, let me just think of other material. So it made my material stand out because I wasn't one of those women talking about relationships. I wasn't talking about that stuff. But then after years, it was like a straitjacket because I couldn't really open up and be completely myself on stage mm-hmm. because I was holding back a facet of my personality. And I didn't really come out till I started touring. I was on tour with Cat Williams and I was touring with I was there for the crazy. I was there on a private jet with Suge Knight. I was there for all of that.
What?
You gotta tell that story.
Crazy shit that was happening. I was there for all of it. But I was on tour. I'll tell you that. I'll come back to that. Okay, but I was on tour, and I was on tour with a young comedian called Shaunte Wayans, she's part of the Wayans dynasty.
Shaunte Wayans,
yeah. And she's a lesbian comic, and I loved how unapologetic she was on stage. And I remember watching her thinking, and envying her thinking, that's what you do. Just be on stage and be yourself. Doesn't matter. And it got to the point where, you know, I'd done all the things that I'm supposed to do, be happy, smiley, non-threatening Gina for years to try and get on, and it hadn't worked. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do me. I'm going to just do me. And I didn't make a big deal out of coming out. I just slipped a joke in here and there, slipped a line in here and there. I didn't make a big deal of it because it's just one facet of my personality.
It doesn't totally define you.
Exactly. But it just means that I was completely open and there was nothing I was hiding and my comedy got better.
How did that feel? Like having that realization, how did it feel?
So good. And I just like, why did I wait so long? Like, oh my God, I wish I'd done this years ago. But when I, you know, back at people going, oh, your black audience will desert you because, you know, black people are homophobic. Nah, and so people were telling me that. But it is, because I'm like, look, I built up a reputation of being a really good comic and really funny. And so people like me, even if you don't, well, then off you go. For every one person I lose, I gain another five. So, yeah, so I wish I'd done it years ago. But, yeah, good. You know, I'm glad I did. But as for Cat Williams, yeah, I was on tour 2012. And, you know, Cat, one of the most generous, giving, supportive people, smartest people I've ever met.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, if you watch his comedy, take out all the motherfuckers. The guy is a genius.
No, Cat is brilliant.
Intelligent. Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant, I tell you.
Yeah, they just let the pimp shit get in the way, but that.
Yeah,
no,
but if you peel away all of that, highly intelligent man. We had wonderful conversations, but I'd have wonderful conversations, and the next day he was like, "I'm like, hey, Canton," and he was just, so I was like, "I don't know what's going on," but you know, I just he respected me because again, I didn't kiss ass, I didn't, you know, but yeah, I was on that tour with Suge Knight. You know, I was left on stage doing hour and a half sets because he. I tell you one story.
That
encapsulate the craziness.
Okay. And at the time, did you have an hour and a half? Did you have an hour and a half of material?
Yeah. Okay,
cool.
I was like, was it just crowd work or,
yeah.
Oh, no, I've been in comedy since 96. I already had.
The queen.
In 2012,
comedy.
I'd already shot two specials. So, yeah.
Ah, okay, gotcha.
I had the material. Let me tell you the story, encapsulate the whole thing. So, I'm on tour. I mean, very generous. The first time Cat was taking me on tour, and he calls me up. He, you know, the first time I met Cat, I'm in New York. It's the New York Comedy Festival. Cat is appearing at the Carnegie Hall. Sold out. And I'm going just to watch the show because my friend Will Silvince was opening for him. So I'm turning up at the theater. I'm about to walk in the front to watch the show. Will Silvince calls me. Where are you? And I'm like, I'm about to walk in the theater and take my seat. He goes, come around to the stage door. So I come around to the stage door and they go, Cat's not here. He's been arrested on the way to the show. So can you go up and do 20 minutes? And I'm like, Carnegie Hall? Fuck yeah. So Will went on, did his time. Then I went on and did mine and killed. And towards the end of my set, Cat Williams had been released by the police and he made it and caught the end of my set. And afterwards he was like, I like you. I'm going to take you on tour. And I was like, yeah, yeah, I've heard that shit before. Whatever. And I was visiting New York from LA. So I was staying at Will's house. The next day I get a call from the woman who books Cat shows. And she's like, Gina, you did Carnegie Hall for Cat. Cat really likes you. He wants to take you. He's doing, what's that place in Jersey that's supposed to be like Vegas, but it's not?
Atlantic City.
Oh, Atlantic City,
Yeah. He goes, Cat's doing Atlantic City tonight. He wants you to open for him. How much did they pay you for Carnegie Hall? Now, they didn't pay me a penny. I just went up and did 20 minutes, but I wasn't going to say that. So I was like, $2,000. And she goes, done. We'll see you tonight. And a car, Mercedes, turned up. And I was like, fuck, I should have said eight. Anyway. So the car picked me up and took me to Atlantic City. And I opened for Cat at Atlantic City. And his backstage was like a scene out of New Jack City. Remember when they had the naked girls just counting money?
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
That's because Cat used to insist that you go get the cash from the box office and pay him. So they used to have to get the box up, let me count. And so all these girls would be just there, just counting all this money and go, bitch, pay Gina. And then the girl would just come over with it. Come over with it.
Oh, you mean that New Jack City scene?
Oh, yeah.
Them skin then, milk and them titties.
One and a two. Of course, y'all remember. Oh, I can't.
I used to date that girl, yo.
With the skin milk in her titties?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Wow. So, yeah, he paid me cash and then he said, I'm going to take you on tour. And I was like, bet. So he calls me up. Cat calls me up and he goes, okay, so I'm going to take you on tour. I've got 100 date books booked around the country. We're going to make a load of money. How much do you get paid? So I was thinking if I say 3,000, he'll knock me down to two. Okay. I'll get $2,000 a show, 100 shows, I'm set. So I go 3,000. And Cat goes, I'll give you five. I'll see you next on Saturday. And I was like, what? And when I first met up with Cat on the tour, I says, I asked for three. Why did you say you'll give me five? And he goes, because I know how good you are. He goes, I know how good. Know your worth, Gina. Know your worth. You're worth more than that. And you're better than that. And he paid me 5,000 shows. Now, I was like, oh my days, 100 shows. I'm going to make $500,000. But after that first show, I was like, oh, we're not going to make it to 3 shows. This is a
And so it was Suge Knight touring? Was he was Suge rolling Knight, with y'all?
Yeah, Suge Knight was touring with us. So let me tell you this quick story. So first night, we're in Denver. We do the show. Packed out. Do the show. I do my set. I kill, have fun. Sean Taylor does a set. It's great. Cat goes on and it's a crazy show. Put it that way. It was when he was not having good shows.
Okay.
Didn't go well. Go backstage. And he goes to the promoter, Live Nation was doing the show. Mm-hmm. He goes to the promoter, go get my money. And they're going, look, people are walking out and they're demanding their money back, so we can't give you the money. And I'm like, and Kat's like, go get my motherfucking money. And I'm like, oh God, about to go. And I turn around and I don't even know what happened. I turn around and I just hear, and I turn back and the Live Nation guy's on the floor. And I'm like, oh God, I got to get out of here. I got to get out of here. The point is, wait, the Live Nation guy got punched in the face. I'm not going to say who did it. I didn't see it. I turned around. I just heard a noise.
And then you saw he was on the ground.
So I was like, oh God, this is crazy. This tour is not, I'm not going to make $500,000. I would be lucky.
But they can't get his money that night, though?
Oh, he got his money. Okay. So, that was the show in Denver. So that was the next day in Denver. That was Denver. The next day, we're supposed to be in Sacramento. So they go, right, meet us all in the lobby at 9 a.m. The plane, we'll get on the plane, we'll go to Sacramento. Cool. We're in the lobby, 9 a.m., 10 a.m., 11 a.m., 12 p.m., 1 p.m. We're all just sitting in the lobby for hours. And I'm like, where's Kat? What's going on? So I'm like, I go up to his room. I just knock on the door.
Yeah.
Yo, Kat, we've been downstairs for 4 hours. What's happening? I'm like, no way, we'll be down soon. So he sends me out, and I'm like, what is going on? Anyway. I was like, aren't we going to miss these flights? And the woman who's booking the show is like, oh no, it's a private jet. They're waiting for us on the runway. Anyway, they charged Kat $30,000 in late fees. I remember that. We get to the runway. So we all get in the convoy. They put our luggage in all the cars. We all go to the runway where the jet is waiting. We get on the jet. I'm on the jet with Suge Knight, Bishop Magic Don Juan. Is that
yes? Yes. Yes. Yeah, green is for the money, gold is for the honey.
Yeah, I'm on a jet with them and Kat's kids and a bunch of other people. And everybody's like, where's Kat? Where's Kat? Why is he? And I was like, he was in the car just behind us. I don't know, where's Kat? This was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at this point. The show in Sacramento was at seven. We are in Denver.
Oh,
show's in Sacramento. And I go, where's Kat? Where's Kat? Kat has decided he's going to drive.
Oh my
from
God.
From Denver to Sacramento. I'm like, maybe I don't know America that well. Hello, Google. How long does it take to drive?
I'm doing that right now.
From Denver to Sacramento. And I remember it going, it was like, oh, it will be 19 hours or something like that. And I was like, we're not going to make the show. It's 4 o'clock. The show's at 7. So we sat on the runway, everybody trying to get hold of Kat. So in the end, the pilot goes, listen, we got to go. Otherwise, this flight is done. We got to take off. So we take off without Kat. And we had to divert the plane halfway through the journey to go pick up Kat in the middle of the desert somewhere. We had to divert the plane and land and pick up Kat. Kat gets on the plane and he's furious at us. I don't know what was going on. He gets on the plane and is like, you motherfucker. And just cursing. And I'm sitting there like, what the hell is going on? What is going on right now?
He thought he was going to make it.
Yeah, so we get to
Sacramento.
We are 2 hours late for the show. Now, John Witherspoon, God bless him, God rest his soul, was also on the tour. But John Witherspoon had learned early on in the tour, not to get on a plane with Kat. He was like, I'll get my own jet there. I'll meet you at the gig. So John was already at the gig. But unfortunately, they told John, oh yeah, Kat's on his way. Just go on stage.
Stretch. Oh, God.
He'd been on stage 2 hours when we got there.
Oh, my God.
Poor Mr. Witherspoon had sweat through his entire suit. Because he'd been on stage for 2 hours to do, and when we got there, he had two girls on stage doing a dance competition because he'd run out of jokes.
He ran out of shit, yeah.
Bang hour.
He came off and he was like, motherfucker.
Oh my God. Yo, this is
now,
bear in mind, my stuff was still in the convoy. So I had to go on stage at this theater to 10,000 people. Wearing a t-shirt, no bra, jeans, and flip-flops because my clothes were still in the convoy driving halfway across the country somewhere. So that was the second night. So I was like, oh, this isn't going to work. But after every night, they paid me my 5,000 cash. So at one point, I did three shows. I had $15,000. And I was like, Suge Knight and his boys, I don't want them to come in my hotel room in the middle of the night and dangle me out of the window for this money. So as soon as we got to the next town, I ran straight to the Chase, like,
to the bank, yeah.
Can I put this money in the bank? And they're all looking at me like I'm a drug dealer because I've got a pile of cash. Can I pay this in, please? Like, and they were looking at me like, and they're counting the money, just looking at me sideways. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a crazy tour. You know, I was there in Seattle. The next night was in Seattle. Again, Kat got arrested on the way to the show. So, Will Sivince did an hour set. I did an hour set. John Witherspoon did an hour set. And by 3 hours in, the crowd is like, what is going on?
Yeah, they're done. Yeah.
And the crowd started to destroy the theater. Like, it was a beautiful theater in Seattle. The crowd went mad because Kat had been arrested on the way. It was crazy. And the next day, we were supposed to be in Texas.
And who routed this tour? Texas?
I know. We were in Texas the next day, 10,000 people, sold out. The people who ran the venue were like, we ain't opening these doors.
Right.
Till we know that Kat is in the city. Because we heard about what happened in Seattle. We heard about what happened in Sacramento. We ain't opening these doors. And the tour manager's like, oh, no, Kat's on his way. But Kat is still in freaking... Kat is still in California. He ain't even left yet. They're like, no, he's checked into a hotel. And the guy's like, no, he hasn't, because we called all the hotels in the area and he's not there. So we ain't open. In fact, if he ain't here by 7 o'clock, we're canceling the show. And obviously, he was never going to. They canceled the show. 10,000 people outside. They canceled the show. So John Witherspoon at this point was like, I'm out. I'm out. And he got on a plane and he went back home. And I was like, well, my flight home was booked from the next city. So I had to get on the tour bus and go to the next city. And obviously, Kat never didn't turn up. And then I just got a plane and went back to LA.
So five shows.
I did five shows. I was paid for three.
Wow. Yeah. That's how he's able to give you five.
But you know what? He paid me more for those shows that I'd asked than I'd asked for. So as far as I'm concerned, he didn't owe me nothing.
Yeah.
Because I'd asked for three, expecting two. He paid me five. So.
Yeah, he's crazy like that. You know, Kat once chased me on a dirt bike. I was driving my car. We did a show. Do you remember the show we did with Lauryn Hill for like the BET Awards, like the BET Awards weekend? It was like Lauren. I forget who it was, but. This guy kept trying to, I thought he was trying to carjack me or something. And the last thing I was expecting was, and it was like those, you know, the bicycles where it's like an adult tricycle.
Oh yeah, the quad bike things.
He had like an adult tricycle.
Those are scary when a dude roll up on you on those.
Right. And I was like, I was near Skid Row. Like we were leaving the Staples Centers, but you know, like Skid Row is near there.
Yeah.
So that's what I thought was. He kept knocking. It's like, it's Cat Williams, nigga. And I was like, why are you chasing me on a bicycle?
Yeah, my cat story. I met Cat one time. I met Cat. Yeah, man.
Oh, everyone got Cat stories.
Dude, I met him once. Yeah, he was at the, we had did a show in, this is a House of Blues back, you know, when House of Blues was in LA on Sunset. And it was like us, I think like us, Dilated Peoples, Kweli, and like some other people. And little brother, I think we were like first or second gone, whatever. But we did the show and it was dope. It went off. And so afterwards, we went up to like the little area where they were just having drinks and just kind of social area. And Kat is there. And he just comes up to me. And like, you know, I think it's his people's wedding. He's like, yo, it's Kat, whatever. You know, he loved the show, whatever. I'm like, oh, that's dope. What's up? So I just walk up to him, like, what's up, man? And he gets it to me. He leans in. He's like, when Obama get in office, the people is going to be looking for something different. And they're going to be wanting something new.
And y'all are going to be part of that something new. And up until the time when you really take off, if you need 20, 30 G's just to put in your pockets, you come holler at me.
Oh, my God.
I was like, what the fuck? And so then he calls his girl over. He's like, yeah, get my number. What? So I'm just talking to this girl. Like, I don't know who she is. I'm just like, okay. Wow. I don't, wait, what the fuck is happening? And I, bro, that's what he said. And I was like, okay. And he gave me, well, I mean, he didn't give me like no money, but she gave me a number and I gave her number to my manager at the time. And I just walked away. I was just like, okay, I don't know what that was.
Yeah, but that's what he does. He used to sit in the back of comedy clubs. And if he liked your set, he'd call you over and go, whatever I got in my pocket is yours. And he'd just take out his money.
Wow.
That's another time I met him. I did a show and he just called me over and he's like, whatever I got in my money, in my pocket. And he took out $500 and just gave it to me. That's what he used to do.
And he was right about your future, Fonte. How about that?
Yeah, he's a good dude.
Yeah, yeah. Whatever
they say about Kat, he's a good dude, a genius comic, One of the best comics working today, without a doubt. Just one of the best. And a good dude. His heart is good. He's crazy, but his heart is good.
My question was totally, I'll say mine for last because it's a totally kind of offbeat question, but I'll let you go.
No, well, I wanted to know, like, what comedians do you enjoy working with, or who do you, not even working with, like, who do you laugh at? Like, who's your favorite?
Gosh, there are so many.
Or is that so general, too general to ask?
You know, obviously the usual suspects, but I like to name comics that people might never have heard of.
Please do.
Like, there's a comedian called Erin Jackson.
Okay.
Hilarious.
Yep, I know Erin, yep.
Funny black woman. Hilarious. And she just did one of Tiffany's specials. And
oh, okay.
I gotta give Tiffany a shout out. Like, she bringing people through. Like, she's putting her money, she put her own money in to make these specials. Mm-hmm. Wow. To make sure that everybody got paid properly. She put her own money in. That's what I'm talking about. She's bringing people through. Like, you know, a lot of people make it and they just don't really go back to pull the others forward. Pull others up with them. Tiffany is not that person.
That's true.
She goes back and she gets the... So, you know, shout out to Tiffany. She's a diamond. But yeah, Erin Jackson, hilarious. Young comedian called Joelle Johnson, hilarious.
I feel like I know
it. Like, there's a lot of black women that are out there just doing good things and they need breaks. There's so many good ones out there. So I like to name.
But look, shout out to Z-Way and my sis that got the comedy special. I mean, on Comedy Central. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're all out there doing it. But yeah, these are comics that should be getting, you know, I'm glad Erin got her special. She got her shine. But yeah, we're a long time in this business. Yeah, we need more. We need more people like that. Yeah. I could name the usual suspects, but that's boring. Everybody names the same.
Right, everyone knows them. Yeah. All right, so now, you know, now that the book is out there, and
Cat Candid, please buy it. It's out today.
Yes,
it's out.
I was going to say
it's a good book.
Do you hope to option it for movie rights to do your life story or
absolutely? If you read,
or is a series?
There are crazy stories in there. I've led a life and I've had a journey, and I definitely want to option it. Serialization.
So my question: what American actress plays Gina Yashere in your movie? In a biography. Who would you cast to play you?
Cynthia Erivo.
Check it.
Yeah, check it.
This might be an unpopular opinion. Mm-hmm. Aretha, I loved her in that Aretha joint.
I loved it. The only place where it fell apart was the singing, and not because Cynthia can't sing. Like, I thought they should have pulled a Ray, but I don't know if they had rights to the music. But where they just,
I don't think Jamie, they
just kind of lip sync. Yeah, no, but I mean, because she can sing.
The family were not they didn't give permission, so they couldn't get all the the famous Aretha songs.
Mm-hmm. You
know? But she's a talented girl. Talented.
She killed that role. I thought she did really good. Yeah. Everybody showed up.
Yeah, she talented, man.
Yeah, he is very talented. Yeah.
Okay, Gina.
So who plays you?
A black Brit. Yeah. Who played? Cynthia Erivo. That's who plays Gina Yashere.
All right, cool.
No, for real.
On the Lifetime special,
the Lifetime version of
a cuter version of me. Yeah.
All right.
Gina. So this is a question I need to know for as a black Brit. It's rare that we get like black Brits on the show. So
okay,
this is a question I've never had a chance to ask. What, in your opinion, is the greatest black British song, and why is it Return of the Mac?
Nigga, the show's over. Yo,
which has not been on Tune Tuesday yet.
Mm-hmm. Hey, let's talk. Come on.
I heard it the other day. I was watching some movie, some TV show, and they used it. And I was like,
it was, I think it might have been, it was your girl, Sam J.
Show. I was like, Return of the Mac.
What was that song like in Europe? Like, what was it going off like over in the UK?
He was about to be a big star. He was about to be a big star, and then he just started getting into trouble, and the press started turning against him, and then his career disappeared. But he was going to be a big star. People were singing that song. He was huge. It was a big song.
Man, I still sing that song. I was a
firsthand witness to that song working.
Yeah, it was a big tune.
I was firsthand witness, but
it was a big tune.
I think he kept like trying to, I think in 95, the thing was sort of like, I got to get more press by being more gangster. Yeah. I always felt like all those arrests that he was getting into was like on purpose just to.
Yeah. And to he generate just messed up his own career because the press turned against him and that was the end of that. It was stupid.
Yeah.
I don't know where he is now. And you got me with that one.
All right. Well, we got to find Mark Morrison. Yes. Well, we thank you for coming
thank
on the
you
show.
For having me. Thank you
so much fun.
Congratulations, man.
Thank you.
Congratulations on some extra freedom. I know you ain't totally free, but you seem freer than most. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Nah, man. I am, and I want to come on that podcast with Jill Scott, too. I love Jill Scott.
All right. I'm going
to. Now, you on that podcast. Oh, that's God. A boy. Listen, yeah. That's a three-parter.
I love Jill Scott. I met her once, and she gave me a number, and I lost it. I was so mad. I was at the BET Awards in 2008. And I was doing red carpet stuff, and her people tried to drag her past me. And I was like, no, you ain't, Jill Scott. I come all the way from England for this shit. You better not walk past me on this red carpet. And then she came back, and she was like, are you the girl from Def Comedy Jam? And I was like, yes. And she was like, oh, you're funny. And I was like, yeah. And then she performed later on in the evening, and it was for all these BET executives, and they were being all too cool for school. Like sitting there pretending, and I got up and I was dancing and mouthing all the words to her songs, and she was like, I like you. And she was like, here's my number. If you ever need anything, call me. And then that fucking phone crashed. And that's it. I never got in touch with Jill Scott, and I was so mad at myself. So tell her
it's done. It's done. No, you're on the show. It's done.
You
got to
book her.
It's done.
That's gonna be crazy. Well, thank you for coming on the show. On behalf of Team Supreme, Laia Fontigolo, and Sugar Steve.
Thank you, Gina.
Thank you very much for having me.
There it is.
So fun.
Gina Yashere, y'all. And this is Questlove. We'll see you on the next go round of Questlove Supreme. Thank you.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte. Make sure you keep up with us on Instagram at QLS and let us know what you think and who should be next to sit down with us. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. All right? Peace.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.